this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Now, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown shining.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howell. We have Greg Pappas on the board. We have S&P futures down 43. NASDAQ futures down 182. Nobody liked Meta's earnings last night. It's down $20. That's 3%. Or Microsoft, which has been up every day. But down 16 yesterday. Down 16 this morning. That's 4%. It was actually up yesterday. So all the big seven this morning here is down on the day so far. We'll see if that holds. I mean, those guys have been up pretty much every day. Do we have Professor Liu?
Good morning, sir.
How are you? There's one other note here that we'll talk about when Carl comes on later. We got to switch Carl's on today, and Dan Janinas is on tomorrow because Dan is flying at the moment. Super Micro is down about 33% as Ernst & Young has resigned as their auditor.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, it's never good.
Is Carl on right now? I could see.
He likes to be on early, so he listens for when he comes on. Plus, he likes to listen to you. He might learn something, you know?
I doubt it. I actually was thinking it was the other way around.
Well, it's both of you guys.
I am here, by the way.
Both of you.
How are you, Carl?
I'm good.
These guys buy a bunch of NVIDIA stuff, right, Carl?
Yeah, they're not just a bunch. They're NVIDIA's third largest customer. And I have long been warning about... let me be fair about these guys. I have one of their server boards sitting in my utility closet at my house. Okay? I love these guys' products. They have a very unique combination of things within their server boards. Okay?
Is this Sun Micro or is this NVIDIA?
No, this is Super Micro.
Okay.
And Super the most Micro. Important one is that they have out-of-band management, so there's another network port in it that allows you to get into the box and do things like turn it on, turn it off, see whether or not the temperature is okay, the fans are all right, you can have it set alarms if something goes wrong there. For servers, this is obviously really, really important. Not so much for a computer on your desk, right? But it is for servers. And they're pretty much the only people that make boards that have this specific combination of things. Now, there is a problem with them in that they're Chinese, and God knows what sort of fun things might be in their firmware in terms of sending home telemetry to mama within the CCP. All right, there's really no way for you to validate that. And by the way, there was a scandal about that about 10 or 15 years ago where some people thought they had caught them doing it. So it's not like I have nuclear secrets on my computer, right? But if you did, this could be a problem. But that because they are a China-based company, and because they're trying to play the AI game, if you look at their chart over the last few years, they have seen a absolutely meteoric rise in their price that has absolutely nothing to do with them making server boards that Netflix uses to feed you videos, right?
Interesting that Ernst & Young is bailing on them, and this
John, you should read the letter that they sent to the SEC. Okay, I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, that was before. Pretty bad. You sent that around.
I just saw the quote that you put up, Carl, and you know, all I can say is I compare this to what happens, you know, when an accountant pulls a plug like this. I compare it to what happens when a lawyer or a law firm pulls a plug on a client, and especially a profitable one. And let me tell you something. It doesn't surprise me with the Chi-Com connection. It does not surprise me that their accounts are running into some kind of ethical issue, but it's got to be significant. I mean, like the accountant is trying to do is what a lawyer does, for example. And thank God I've never had to do this, but I have had partners who've had to do this. Stand up in court in the middle of a trial and tell the judge, Your Honor,
sorry.
Right. I need to withdraw. And you're not allowed to tell the court why, because right. You've got an ethical obligation to your client. You're not allowed to tell the court why, but that is when an attorney says that, or when an accountant says something like this, what they're saying is, my client is doing something really bad. I can't exactly tell you what it was because I've got ethical obligations to the client, but this is my way of alerting, you know, the regulatory agencies and in my case, a court, that either my client has committed perjury or my client is engaged in something. And it effectively means I'm leaving a sinking ship, you know, I'm happy to be one of the rats because I don't want to get dragged down with these people
right.
when this all comes to light.
So, sorry to interrupt, guys. Where exactly were these guys $100 ago?
Well, this is always the problem, though. Chief, you and I and everybody else, we've all seen this, right? A dozen times. I mean, this is back to 1990s type crap, or you know what went on during the.
Because at the beginning of 24, their stock was what, like 20 or something, and then it went all the way up to 120. Where was everybody pulling out at 100?
Well, obviously not there, right?
Well,
general
I mean,
question.
We don't know. We don't have enough information. But typically, Greg, what happens is when you find something like this, you don't just pull the plug. You go to the client. You sit down. You say, "Look, here's what's going to happen. Okay, this is a problem. You're breaking the law. You have the potential to drag us down with you. And this, by the way, is all done in writing, because you want a paper trail going back to when you discovered the problem. You want to show that you counsel the client to try it out, because you have ethical obligations as well. You can't just walk out the door on something like this, pulling a plug on your auditing and accounting functions. That damages the client. So you've got ethical obligations not to damage the client unless absolutely necessary. So you put a paper trail in place. This is going on. We can't live with it. You need to change things. Here are some options on how we could fix this, et cetera, et cetera. So it could have been going, that process could have been going on for months, especially if they've got a command or a control chain that runs all the way back to Beijing. So it wouldn't surprise me if this is a 6-month process where they've been talking to them, trying to work out some alternative to them bolting, because as Carl and Tom just noted, this is a very public warning that something is wrong with this company.
I want to pull back a little bit even before Greg's question. When you get involved in something, I mean, there used to be all these, when I started, there used to be all these rules on the New York Stock Exchange. All these guys, I think, are a NASDAQ listing, but still, of what you had to do to be listed there. I mean, it was a big deal. I mean, you had to, the ownership, the stock had to be votable, all kinds of stuff. Now, when you get involved in a company like this, like an Ernst & Young, you know, take an Alibaba, for instance. I mean, the thing is, the management is a goat bleep. I mean, the stuff is owned by Jack Ma, who we don't see him anymore. The company is essentially an income stream out of Bermuda or someplace. When you go to audit someplace like that, what exactly do you think you're getting yourself into? I mean, it's like, here's the snake pit. Come on in. I mean, What do you expect?
Well, Chief, this is the basic problem with the game. And again, you know, how many times, how much of our podcast times have we spent on this? Okay, you know, in the show and my columns,
yeah,
over the last, you know, 15 years, that there are essentially no real accounting controls in China. Okay, not the way we think of them, anyway. That the CCP, the PLA, which by the way is the military part of the Chinese government, just like the DOD is ours, is not only a piece of pretty much every business there, it's required to do business there. And if you don't do it, you don't do business there. Okay, I mean, fellows, the guys that make a very mundane company, they made paper shredders.
Well,
right? I mean, okay, but look, you know.
All right, so I'm gonna ask.
I'm just saying, they move their factory over to China, their intellectual property gets ripped off and copied, and the company basically gets destroyed.
Well, I'm going to ask Lou, if you're the general counsel of Ernst & Young and you pick these guys or somebody like them, and there's a lot of them around that have trails back to China and other places, does the hair go up on the back of your neck the day these guys become a client? And what do you expect your people to do, and how closely do you, I mean, what are you looking for if you're the general counsel of Ernst & Young? Lou, are you there?
Well, I think you lost him. Well, here's the thing. You have to have an auditor in order to be on a public exchange. Well,
that's what I'm saying, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, and what does an auditor look for? A check.
And when the check stops coming, then you drop the client.
Well, these guys, the checks, I'm sure, are still coming. What happened to Lou? Did we lose him in a big thunderstorm?
He seems to have disappeared. I'm sure he'll come back.
Maybe he was talking crap about the Chinese and they cut him off.
Yeah, they cut his line.
Lou said they just lost power. That'll do it.
Yeah. Well, the Chinese, you know, they have some of their control. Oh, they have control boards in those transformers because, you know, they all come from China. You ain't talking about that no more.
No, I mean, if all of a sudden they blast Carl off, we know we got a problem.
Well, you know, if all of a sudden I disappear, it's because that Chinese cable modem that's sitting in my utility closet right next to the Chinese motherboard server, they sent down a nuke that SOB signal to the cable modem and destroyed it.
God. Well, the thing isn't plugged in, is it?
Well, of course it's plugged in. How do you think it gets
power? I don't
know.
You said it was in the closet. You didn't say it was plugged in.
Well, of course, my utility closet has power.
Right,
in it.
If I had a computer in my closet, it'd be because I wasn't using it. I have different terms than you use.
No, you know, utility closet, like where your hot water heater is.
All right, okay. God. Anyway, you just wonder, you know, what do you? I guess I'm very curious since you sent this yesterday. I think obviously Lou is too. I hope he gets back on. What do you expect when you go in there? It's not, I'll use the term, a regular firm, and you expect something different. How different does it really have to be from what you thought it was different for you to bail out? I mean, they must know it's a difficult engagement. They must know that a lot of stuff is not going to be as forthcoming as maybe you'd like. How bad does it have to be even worse than that? So I think you're sort
I'm
of
it has, cash to, it has to comply with the law.
Yeah, I know.
When it doesn't, you get something like this.
Well, okay, but go back to my example of Alibaba. It's not going to be the same audit of PTI or Carl's computers. I mean, how can it be? I mean,
well, why in the hell wouldn't it be? I mean, you know,
we're gonna go through accounts receivable or the same.
Oh no, Chief, I know what you're saying. Okay, but the reality is that the books are the books, right? All right. I mean, it's like people argue all the time in the context of the government, the federal government, that, oh, you know, Social Security is bankrupting everybody. You know, we have to, da, da, da. And you hear this all the time, all right? The actual financials say that it's Medicare and Medicaid, all right? And it's right there for anybody that cares to look. Now, the problem is if you're an auditor in a public company, you know, the government, of course, can play all kinds of games, and nobody ever goes to jail for, you know, if you're part of the government and you BS people on a constant basis, nobody goes to jail for that, ever. But if
you do that as an auditor of a public company. Yeah, you might.
Well, I mean, but it is, but it's also, I mean, I actually have, this is a long, long time ago, but I have experience with something sort of like this, in that Ernst & Young, the same place, were they Ernst & Ernst in those days? Were they Ernst, and then they were Ernst & Winnie for a while, weren't they? Anyway,
I had a very good, by the way, I had a very good friend of mine that was a partner in one of those companies that used to do my books, and after he left and was in private practice, and he was also an enrolled agent, and he was the guy that did my stuff for MCS, because, you know, you don't want to go to jail, right? Even if you're not a public company, you want to make sure your taxes are right.
Well, my brother Dan's first job, he was a CPA coming out of Notre Dame, and then he got his MBA at DePaul, and his first job was with Ernst. Was it Ernst & Ernst back then? It was Ernst & somebody. I think it was Ernst & Ernst. But and then it became Ernst & Winnie, and then it became Ernst & Young, right? Because they bought Arthur Young.
Yeah,
isn't that the way it works? Something like that. Anyway, he used to do audits. Guess what one of his audits was? Was the Central States Teamsters Union.
Oh, there you go.
And he's auditing this stuff, and he, you know, you don't tell anybody about it. He goes, yeah. He's Dan, what about those loans to all the Vegas casinos? He goes, they're best performing loans. They're fine. They get paid back every nickel with interest. There's nothing wrong with those. Anyway, Ernst & Ernst was the auditor at Pullman when we were doing this Amtrak car contract, and the thing was so far delayed, they were predicting a profit on it, and of course there really wasn't any profit at this point, and so the thing kept degrading, and they sent so many people auditing around the place. Matter of fact, they had this one very attractive young lady, and she says, "My boss says take her around the plant." I said, okay. Now, this is when you have to climb the steps to get on these cars, right? I said, do me a favor, will you? She goes, what's that? I go, you got to wear pants tomorrow. Why do I have to wear pants? Just trust me, will you? I mean, so all of a sudden she's clambering up these steps with all these guys out there welding like beneath her and stuff. And she goes, all right, see, I see why you want me to wear pants. But I mean, you know, in those days, there were no computers, right, that people right. had. So it was all the 14-column, 16-column paper stuff, which, by the way, I still use. But when these guys left, Kyle, you know those big, huge army trunks? The big, old, huge army trunks? That's how much stuff they would go through. We have a message here for you. Says the Greg, tell Lou to use the Zoom app on his phone. It'll work.
No, I'm already.
Oh, you're already back.
I'm running on my phone's hotspot.
Okay,
But it's completely dark. It's one of these deals where I can see lights across the street, but my side of the street is completely blacked out.
So they cut off your whole block just because you were talking crap about Chinese.
Well, I was right. talking crap. I was about to talk crap about the Russians because unlike
there you go.
I mean, among your Co or your guest, Tom, I'm probably the only one that's set up companies in an operating dictatorship. And when I worked in Russia in the 90s, this was the issue that you guys were talking about, which was how do we deal with, you know, an incredibly corrupt society where basically the government is a kleptocracy and you're in bed. It wasn't so much in bed with Russian defense people. It was in bed with a federal state security / mafia combination that was effectively dealing with every business that looked like it was going to turn a profit. So we had the same ethical considerations that Carl was mentioning. And Carl, I don't know if you remember this, but what was it like? Maybe back in 2013 or 2014, there was a sort of a semi meltdown in the Chinese markets because people were suddenly realizing that the government wasn't going to let them do certain, you know, basic accounting activities. And I remember sitting talking to Tom and saying, they're communists. What did you expect? It's a communist dictatorship. What did you expect was going to happen?
Well, you know, it was and by the way, there's there's an ugly precedent for this, Chief.
Oh, but guys, if my power if I did disappear again, it's going to be something a little more sinister now that we're bad-mouthing the Russians.
Oh, God. Yeah, you got a missile through your window.
A Scud landed on your head.
That's right.
If you remember, in the early part of 2007, I think it was February, all of a sudden, and this was why I started writing my column, actually. So I woke up one morning, I turned on the TV, at the time I still had cable service in my trading console, and the U.S. market was okay, but the Chinese market had taken a huge dump. It was enormous. And I looked at it and I go, oh, that ain't good. and I went looking around, okay, why'd that happen? And of course, CNBC is soft pedaling it. Well, there's this big crash, but not saying anything about what it was. And that was the precursor that got me awake to start looking at what was going on with the bank financials and stuff like this. And started writing the columns and ultimately we know what happened in 2008. This is probably, if this spreads, and I suspect it will, it is going to be way worse because NVIDIA is essentially a captive company to a handful of firms in terms of who they sell their products to. The expensive ones anyway, not the video cards that go in your computers, but these H100s and then these new...
What percentage of their business do you think are those things, Carl? Do you have any idea?
What percentage of what's...
NVIDIA's business...
90% of what's driven their stock appreciation over the last few years. Okay, you're talking about a 90% wipeout in NVIDIA if this ends up spreading.
Oh, that wouldn't be good.
Well, yeah, and by the way, all the other companies that have ridden on the back of the AI craze and screaming, which is like all of them, go with them. Okay, it's not just NVIDIA.
Lou, you probably have heard this and you know this, but just when you look at NVIDIA, there's, because of the split, there's 25 billion shares outstanding. So every time the thing's down a buck, it's $25 billion in market cap or up. It's unbelievable the amount of money that the place is worth.
When Carl said the magic word NVIDIA, I went, uh-oh. What do you guys think has happened with Ernst & Young? What triggered this?
They found something bad enough that it
overrode their profit motive.
Well, yeah. So I mean, essentially they found something in the financials that they cannot give an audit opinion on. Without basically saying, by the way, the company's bankrupt, which would kill it instantly.
My brother was talking about, Rob, you were saying it on some of the CNBC stuff yesterday, they were talking about some kind of a board shakeup there, too. Is that caused it, or is that part of it, or what is it?
Well, I'm sure...
That would be a symptom.
Well, yeah, because if you're a board member and you find out about it, you're like, hey, wait a minute, I got to sign the... because supposedly, at least under Sarbox, right? I mean, of course, we know nobody ever goes to jail under that, even though you're supposed to. You have to sign those,
unless you're a presidential appointee or candidate.
Yeah,
yeah.
Then they'll contort it to get you. Though I mean, that was the Jack Smith. That was the Jack Smith.
Right. I know. DC. Yeah. I'm just saying. Sarbox is. But Sarbox. Could be as simple as well. We're. We think that going into the Capitol somehow violates that act too. And there's. Never doubt the government's willingness to twist something to suit their purposes in either direction, whether it's ignoring someone who's doing it or going after someone who's not. But, if you see board resignations, obviously, if you see, the controller says, okay, bye, I'm gone, that's usually bad.
Well, there's somebody in the board, haven't been on one, there's somebody who's in charge of the audit committee, of the internal.
Right, right.
Lou, you missed the question during your outage. Is that if you're the general counsel of Ernst & Young and you get these guys or somebody like them as a client, what irregularities, it's a bad term, what differences are you sort of willing to put up with knowing where their ownership is and what kicks you over the line to say when you say no more? This is
a great segue to what I was thinking about sitting here in the dark, about what would have triggered this, and then what are your ethical obligations to report this stuff? So normally it's client first, you know, you can't do anything that damages your relationship with your client. But let's say that finally Ernst & Young gets information that essentially shows that the Chinese have planted spyware, firmware that spies on you, and all of this stuff, and it's just pumping information back to the Chinese government right and left. What's your obligation to disclose that, and under what circumstances? I would, if I was general counsel, I would say, okay, we have to withdraw, and then we can report it to the CIA or NSA or whoever we talk to.
How would an auditor ever find it? Or something like that.
How would an auditor find it?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know how an auditor would find it, but in the process of auditing, you walk through and talk to people. It's actually more likely that the general counsel here in the United States might have come across something that he then is ethically obligated to report to the auditor.
Okay.
Because the attorney's relationship is with the corporate entity. It's not with individuals in the company. You get into, I mean, I can, we could have a whole show on this. In fact, I teach on this. But it's a case involving, it's called Upjohn, and it involves what happens when an attorney doing an investigation on behalf of the company and unwittingly forms an attorney-client relationship with an individual member of the company who is doing wrong. So I was just sort of looking at this going, okay, how bad does it have to be? It's got to be really bad, because if you're the auditor, you're looking at this saying, whatever this conduct is, it's gonna. If I don't cut myself loose here, I'm gonna get dragged down with it. So,
do you think the audit committee of the firm spotted it first, or Ernst & Young spotted it first and told the audit committee at the firm, or we don't know?
I think I would object to the use of the word spotted, which would indicate that somebody was actually looking for trouble.
Okay.
I think these guys, the audit, their internal management team, may well have been aware of the issue and simply looked around and said, "Yeah, we can rationalize this, or we can sweep it under the rug and the auditors won't find it." More likely the former. We can rationalize this misconduct. This is the way, in my experience, these kinds of things develop. Your leadership team says we can deal with this. We have an escape route or a justification that we think the lawyers can rely on, and the auditor comes in and finally bumps up against it and says, "What are we doing?" The leadership of the firm says, "Oh no, it's okay. Our general counsel has crafted this, you know, this argument," and all of a sudden images of Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani come into my mind. You know, release the Kraken, but we've got this legal justification that we rely on, and the auditor says, "Well, I got lawyers too, and I think you're crazy."
The one eyebrow goes up and
we're
says,
"Getting out of here."
Yeah, the one eyebrow goes up and says, "You can't be serious." That's right.
Yeah. Surely you must be joking. Yeah. No, we're not, and don't call us Shirley.
Yeah, don't.
I think that is likely the way it went. I was just trying to figure out what it could have been. It would have to be something that is significant enough to do damage to Ernst & Young's professional reputation, because that's the really scary thing you worry about. An internal, you know, misstep or something like that, or good faith reliance on something that turns out to be problematic is not going to cause your accounting firm to withdraw or your lawyers to withdraw.
Well, plus accounting firm.
The next move, by the way, I'd like.
Oh, I was going to mention one weird thing here about auditors, and then maybe we have a very, very short break. And I want to talk about that article you sent out, the one about the missiles and so forth.
Okay.
But you know what's kind of weird about this is it the big, what they started as, Carl, the big eight, big seven, big six, whatever the hell they were, the accounting firms, now we're down to like four or five, but they have resisted for decades, you know, maybe a century, of having a regulator. They don't want one.
Right.
Well, now, okay, the problem with that is, well, the good news is you don't have a regulator breathing down your neck. The bad news is you do something wrong, it ends up in court. Where if Merrill Lynch can do something egregious and get spanked by the SEC and they get one of these without admitting or denying, even though it sure as hell looks like a felony to me, and a fine. Well, an accounting firm doesn't have that luxury. If they end up, if these guys don't bail out, like Lou says they obviously had to, and somehow they end up in court and they get a felony, they got a problem.
I mean, they're going to get hammered.
Yeah, they got a big problem. Yeah. But they don't, I mean, people think the regulators watch people. They sort of do, but they also are your insulator between you and the courts. I mean,
that is so corrupt.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It needs to be destroyed. And I don't care how it's, I'm at the point now where I don't care how we destroy it. I don't even care if it's lawful.
Well, it's, I hope we're not there yet.
I'm there.
But Lou, I mean, is that just in theory, I mean, the New York Stock Exchange, for a long period of time, hid behind the SEC. You know, the SEC.
Yeah, well, so did a whole bunch of other people over the last 30 years, right?
Well, yeah. Big firms do it now in my business. All right. Let's go to a quick break and let's talk about the. Because the reason why I want to not miss that, Lou, is because we had Mike Murphy on yesterday, and he was talking about.
Yeah, listen to Mike.
He was talking about some of the supply stuff, and he comes from not a different angle, but he was actually into ordering the stuff. But he didn't have the overall picture as much maybe as you might. Anyway, S&P futures down 43. That's a number. NASDAQ futures down 191. So big moves are in Meta down 17 and Microsoft down 16 as they both had earnings last night. Be right back after a very quick break.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Have you ever heard the expression, the customer is always right?
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right
now. Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures down 44. Again, we're going to be brief here. NASDAQ Futures down 192. Big movers. Meta down 16, Microsoft down 16, so that's got the Dow. Dow's down 198, so what's 16 times 7? That's 102 right there, and the Dow is the Microsoft, because don't forget, Microsoft is in, the multiplier there is like 7. Over in Asia, got the Nikkei down 196.5%, Hang Seng down 63.3%, Shanghai up 13.4%, so mixed bag over there. Europe, all down, DAX down 95.5%, FTSE down 65.8%, CAC around down 67.9. Oil up 45 cents, but still under 70, 69.06. We've got gold down 12, but still 27.88. Almost, must have touched 2,800 this morning, but silver down 43 cents, 33.64. We've got interest rates, or FX, sorry. The euro is still at 108.6, so much weaker than it was a month ago. British pound 129.7, kind of unchanged. And we've got the... What are we doing here on the interest rates? For some reason, we're not getting interest futures here. Crypto up 359, 72,273. Real quick, traffic, weather, sports. Did Yankees have money on that game last night or what? Boy, that one inning was like I've never seen.
That was the fifth inning.
Yeah, brutal. The fifth inning.
Yeah. So it is 640 here in Chicago. We've got 63 degrees right now. High of 66. Probably a temperature drop and maybe a couple of showers this morning. Otherwise, traffic inbound Kennedy from Montrose 24 minutes, Edens from Lake Cook 39 minutes, Eisenhower from Wolf 28 minutes. Ryan from 95th is 20 minutes, and the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 27 minutes. NFL, the 6-2 Texans play the 2-6 Jets tonight. That will be terrible. NBA Bulls beat the Magic at home. That was 102-99. And in the World Series, Dodgers win. They beat the Yankees with an unbelievable 5-inning, 5-run comeback. And that was 7-6.
3 years.
And Soto's now a free agent, I believe.
So really?
That's all I got, Chief.
Thank you, guys. Stupid baseball question. Back in the day, the earned run average, obviously, is if there's an error and there's a run after that, the pitcher's not charged with it. I seem to recall, guys, that way back in the day, if the pitcher made the error, it was considered an earned run. It wasn't somebody else's error, it was his. Somewhere that rule changed, I think, because the pitcher made one of the errors last night and didn't cover first base.
That was Garrett Cole.
Yeah.
I saw it. That was.
And Rizzo didn't bother running.
When I saw that, and I just thought, what just happened? I guess he thought the first baseman could get there with
a little effort. Pitcher's supposed to run there.
Yeah, you're not supposed to think. You're supposed to run.
Cole was too cool for school there.
Well, the guy, the throw from the shortstop to the third base that hit the ground 5 feet in front of him was interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That was a meltdown. You know, I haven't seen something like that in a long time where you just see what was it, like three or four errors in a row on major plays with what's his face dropping the ball in the outfield. I mean, it's a routine fly, taking his eye off the ball.
Whoops.
And then the misjudgment at first, and then the jam at third. I mean, just wow.
Yeah. So Lou, continued discussion a little bit yesterday. After all this supply, and clearly it appears, and we'll talk more second hour with Kyle, it almost seems like our enemies, for lack of a better term, are trying to nip us at every side and bleed us to death. It's almost the Ronald Reagan school, what he did to the Russians, or what we did to the Russians when he was in office. They're trying to drain us. I mean, they know we got problems with budgets here, and every time they make us, you know, fire a $1 million missile after a drone somewhere, they figure they got one in the wind column, right? Even if the drone goes down, nobody seems to care. I mean, so if we had to put together a list, sort of like Mike was talking about, and you sent the article yesterday, how many this kind of missiles are we short? If we had an ideal inventory right now across everything Army, Navy, Air Force uses, and how much they like to have in storage, what percentage do you think we're down? Are we down? We can't be 60% of normal of desired inventory across massive amounts of bullets, missiles, you name it. Can we?
Well, yeah. The short answer is yes, we can. And the long answer is, you know, what do we do to, or how fast can we turn our industrial capability around to deal with it? You are exactly correct in that. For the listeners, what the article I sent Tom was a finally into the mainstream press. The realization has crept that we are expending ordnance, very expensive ordnance, at a high rate to defend ships in the Red Sea, to deal with the issues with the Israelis, to support the Ukrainians, all of which takes ordnance that we desperately need, or that we're going to desperately need, away from the place where we think a major power war is likely to break out, and that is the East or the Western Pacific, you know, around China. And so the question, you know, becomes what are we doing? I actually had sent you, Tom, a message earlier, but shortly after this Houthi thing started in the Red Sea, noting that, you know, we were expending $1 million missiles to shoot down $20,000 drones, and that this was an exchange that we couldn't keep up. The discussion over production rates, you know, we produce, I think the last figure I saw was we produce less than 50 missiles a year of the SM-6s and SM-3s that are the backbone of our Navy's defense, air defense, and offensive strike capabilities. They're unbelievably capable missiles. They're expensive. They're $1.3 million, I think, a shot. But they are very capable missiles. They're capable of being fired from a ship. They're capable of being fired from an aircraft, as we've demonstrated. And they're anti-air. They're anti-ship, and anti pretty much anything else you shoot them at. In some cases, anti-satellite. So a highly capable missile does a tremendous amount covers a tremendous number of threats, but we can't make them fast enough, and the fact that it's finally crept up to the level of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff sitting down and trying to sort out how we procure these things is a marker of trouble, and I think our stocks. I think the estimate was we would run out of 155 millimeter artillery shells in about 15 days. We had that discussion, Tom, earlier in the year. In about 15 days, if we were using the stuff at the rate we're seeing the Ukrainians and the Russians trading, and of course a major fight with China would be something like that. Although it would be even worse because we've got a lot of 155 millimeter shells and we're cranking them out as fast as we can. Nobody except maybe the Israelis and now maybe the Koreans can produce the missiles that we need or that we're going to need to defend our ships, to defend our air bases. We're it, and we have not tooled up our production capacity with our industry. Part of the reason is our procurement system, which, you know, you could spend, if you're a defense contractor, and this is one of the reasons why our weapons are so expensive, you could spend, you know, $500 million tooling up to manufacture the SM-3 or SM-6 missile, and in 2 years you produce, you know, 200 of the things, and then Congress cuts the contract. And you're suddenly out. So there are all kinds of risk issues, and your accounting people are telling you don't bid on these contracts. We can, without the risk, we can make a lot more money doing something else.
Lou, if you've never been a part of a fiasco like that, I actually was. I kept badgering the people. Badgering was a good term, by the way. People at the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority about spare parts while the line was still running, while we were still producing them, and how cheap they would be. They never got back to me until my boss assumed they didn't want anything. Took all the lines down, and then they said, oh, by the way, here's what we want. It was like, you might as well send that to the kid down the block. We had no more capability of producing the thing once we tore everything apart in the Man in the Moon. That's what you're talking about. It's even worse than what you said. It's way worse. If all of a sudden you let this drop, then it's not coming back.
Well, and you know, we don't. One of the supposed wake up calls watching what was happening in Ukraine was how fast we were expending, or we would be expending, munitions. You know, basic stuff, bullets, you know, artillery shells, and these missiles. And as I said, it's going to be worse. It's going to be worse than Ukraine in the sense that we're not going to be shooting very many 155 millimeter artillery pieces. The Taiwanese will be, and maybe some other people, you know, in the Philippines, because I don't think China's going to stop at Taiwan. We're going to be expending these missiles. And we can crank out 150. You know, we can ramp up our 155 millimeter production in you know, 6 months to a year, to help make that, because those are relatively unsophisticated. And I say relatively, they're relatively unsophisticated rounds. But a missile, a guided missile with the capability to be fired out of one of our vertical launch systems or off an aircraft, is a whole different ballgame. And that is a very, very complex piece of equipment. And ramping up the production for that is a multi-year process.
John, it's way worse than that. Okay, and I've been pointing this out for a long time too. There are plenty of components in those devices
just all the way down to like the little power supply on your computer on your desk. We do not make
yes
at all, and it would take years to stand up the fabs to be able to get those devices. And we're talking about basic stuff, power regulators. Okay, I mean, little chip without which you cannot take the rail supply, the you know, the battery that supplies the power in the missile. Obviously, you have to have power once it gets launched, right? Little power regulator chip in there that takes that voltage and makes sure that it is exactly the correct voltage and current delivery for the integrated circuits and such that, you know, that work for the guidance system, right? Those are mundane things. And yet there is no U.S. source, none. Go on. I can take the power supply on my desktop computer apart. I can go take the part numbers off of these things. Go on Mouser, DigiKey, and every single one of them sources to China.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I don't think we've been engaging in strategic stockpiling of that mundane stuff.
Oh, I mean, no, and we have zero capacity to make it today in the United States. And you cannot stand up a factory to make those things in 6 months. It's not happening.
Carol, why is that? Are they're just not profitable pieces? You know, is it polluting to make them? What's the reason
why
nothing's
different? Well, it's a little of everything, okay? First off, slave labor is very cheap.
I was about to say when you don't have to pay your people to manufacture the
slave labor is amazingly cheap compared to not, right, John? And you know, and then you also have environmental regulations because semiconductor manufacturing is an inherently dirty business, and so in order to comply with reasonable, you know, why we have clean water and clean air today and clean and reasonably clean ground, in order to comply with that costs money. If you could just dump the noxious chemicals that come out of the back end of your process into the closest river, well, that's a lot less money. It's a lot cheaper. And guess what? You can do that in China, but you can't do that in the U.S. So it's a combination of things. But when you get down to it, those are the most important ones, is that it's cheaper. Yep. And nobody will pay the extra 25 cents. And, you know, Apple makes their phones over there, right? And there have been some analysts that in the past have said, well, you know, remember when Trump was in office, he was talking about, I'm going to tariff everything that comes out of China and basically force the manufacturing back in the United States.
Well, he's saying more of that now.
Well, you know what? And you know what the analysts said? They said that would double the price of an iPhone. Yep. Well, wait a minute. If you're telling me that it would double the price of an iPhone to do that, then what does that say about every other single thing that we have that's over here? And by the way, they're not doing that because they're better, faster, and cheaper than us. They're doing it because they're slaves and they're dumping all the trash on the planet.
Well,
I was involved in the setup of a major chip manufacturing operation in Northern Virginia back in the late 90s. I was counseling their hiring and labor work, and they went out of business. And I mean, they started the rifts. I was involved in the reductions in force, and I kept saying, "Why are we doing this?" Well, because you know we can't compete with the products coming in from China. And I said that there are a bunch of communists over there. I'm not a huge fan of government industrial policy, but this is one area where we should have been setting up, pumping money into the maintenance of some kind of nascent chip manufacturing. We don't even have the capability to get our most necessary circuit boards except through Taiwan. And what is it? The other place is Holland, right? In the Netherlands?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you look at I can take one of these things apart. These are mundane devices that we all have. But every one of those things, all that stuff that's in there, is also absolutely necessary for essentially every piece of warfighting equipment that uses electronics that we have, and that's almost all of them.
Yeah.
Lou, quick question while you're still here. In terms of equipment, I mean, I think we're all in agreement on this. I don't know how you, if you're in a Pentagon, I don't know how you buy it from somebody who doesn't exist, but obviously that's the problem. There's nobody here to buy it from. But what if we were to, we obviously have incredible pieces of warfare equipment, right? But we're also, it seems like whenever we wander our way down to fight a jungle war or something, you end up fighting a war on other people's terms, and our equipment doesn't exactly match up. I mean, I see this thing going on, I mean, I don't see it like you see it, but in the Red Sea, and I'm almost sitting there going, give me a World War II pilot in a P-51 in a cannon, and he can take care of all these gunboats, and he can take care of all these drones. We don't need a missile. I mean, should we have somewhere, I know this would be an anathema in the Pentagon, should we have a dumbed-down part of the military to deal with stuff like this? I mean, why don't we have a submarine that's 50 feet long that pops out of the water with a 3-inch cannon and blasts these guys as they come out of the harbor? I mean, we really don't need an Ohio-class sub to do that, do we? I mean,
Well, no, and a part of the reason that we've gotten into this idiotic position is because of our defense strategy dictated by our political leadership that says we don't want to attack Iranian proxies directly. We're going to shoot down the arrows rather than going and shooting the archer, and that is an inherently wasteful and expensive and ultimately ineffective policy, because you know the archer says I can shoot as many arrows as you know I want, and nothing's going to happen to me. And this is why the attacks, you know, when they shot a missile at the Israelis, the Houthis shot a missile at the Israelis shot the missile down, and then they went in and they bombed the hell out of their harbor.
What I'm saying is that, I mean, I get, I mean, I'm with you on that, but it seems to me nobody wants, I'll use an example, nobody wants the warthogs. It looks to me like if you had two warthogs going up and down that coast 24/7, nobody'd get out of the harbor because of that big cannon on the thing. And by the way, I'm saying,
yeah, but it's but the A-10 is,
I'm just using that as an example.
Okay, so the Air Force is in fact buying so-called coin counterinsurgency aircraft that are you know, low-tech prop turboprop driven aircraft that can loiter over a place for a long time and do some damage. Ideally, our whole counterinsurgency structure was supposed to be the thing that supported our special operations forces. We are not good at fighting the low-tech wars, because the low-tech wars aren't strategic, you know, then in the sort of national survival sense. We made some, and I will just tell you this right now, we shifted our focus to the low-intensity conflicts in under Obama, when Gates and his people, who I have a lot of respect for Robert Gates, but he made a couple of terrible decisions, basically said, you know what, we don't think we're going to be engaging any peers anytime soon, and you know, this is the Russia call that wants its foreign policy back. We're not going to engage these people anytime soon. They're really not much of a threat. We don't need the F-22s. We don't need the high-tech weapons. What we need is low-tech stuff. And that was our focus, Tom, for two decades. And we're paying the price for it right now.
Where are the low-tech weapons?
We produced lots of stuff that was designed to deal with low technology conflicts. Our entire drone fleet was set up to do that. That was part of it, part of the operation.
Well, is it successful? Is it working?
The drones that we use.
I'm saying we do have some.
I mean, we did that kind of thing. We bought the bullets. We bought the cannon shells. We bought the drones. We did a ton of that stuff, and to the neglect of our Navy.
Guys, I got a good idea. What if we turn the A-10s into drones?
God.
Well, we actually do that.
Bingo.
With our F-16s and older fighter aircraft. They are automated, and we use them for dissimilar air combat training and target training over in Nellis and over our target areas off the coast of Florida, the west coast of Florida. So we do automate our aircraft and the old ones. The A-10 is I mean, it's a lovely aircraft.
I'm just using that as an example. I'm saying...
Yeah. But it's the low-tech stuff, which what we want to do is we want to buy weapon systems that will function across a wide spectrum of conflict. The A-10 is a very narrow band of conflict, and those kinds of aircraft at low-tech have very limited capabilities. That's why drones make more sense than airplanes for that kind of thing. You can put a bunch of them up in the air and do whatever. But Chief, the short answer is the most important thing in a low intensity conflict is people. You got to have people to put on the ground, and because we're casualty averse, unlike the Russians and unlike the Chinese, we are casualty averse. Our people have to be protected. So we spent a lot of money on up armoring, basic vehicles, up armoring, light aircraft, up armoring our people with body armor and all that. That's where our focus was.
Well, it's not so bad if you can do everything, but you can't do everything. That's the problem.
That's right. We can't do everything.
And I don't like the fact that we're getting. It's almost like there's three Ronald Reagans, and every place they get a chance to nip us, they do.
Oh no! This is why China and Russia are supporting Iran. They're pumping money into Iran. This is why lifting the sanctions on Iran back in the 2021 was such a disaster, because suddenly now they have money. They can ship their oil to China. That dark fleet that you sent the article out about that you talked about yesterday off the Straits of Malacca. All of that is just providing money to regimes that are essentially coordinating now. And I mean, if you needed any proof of that, 10,000, the 10,000 North Korean troops that got sent to Ukraine are I think just the start. They're not really that many. The Russians are mobilizing, I think it's 130,000 a month. So 10,000 is not going to make that much difference, but they can be used as shock troops, and it may very well be the camel's nose under the tent of a joint Russia-North Korean operation in Ukraine and in Europe. Believe me, the Baltic states see that, and Poland looks at that, and they say time to start ringing the alarm bells. Now, if we could just get the Germans to do the same thing.
Yeah, we might have to have Mike comment on that after spending so much time over there, maybe next week. But
and the Brits and the French.
Lou, do you have to go, or can you hang, or what do you want to do?
I gotta run. I'm getting a little nervous about it, what the temperature's doing in the house right now.
So guys across the street have lights and you do not.
Yeah, I just saw a truck with flashing lights go by, so I assume that's the power people trying to find out where the cutoff is, but yeah.
I hope the thing didn't land on somebody's neck when the wire went down. You guys got high winds out there or something?
Yeah, I think it's probably, we went below freezing last night, so I think it's probably a transformer.
Yeah. All right, but we'll talk at you next week. Hey, great stuff, as usual. And we'll continue on with Carl here.
Carl, a pleasure. See y'all.
It was great having the both of you guys, because it's, Kevin was mentioning that not only does he pretty much love everybody on the show, he thinks when people get a chance to cross-pollinate a little bit, it really helps.
Isn't the first that time. What we're doing before the election?
Next Thursday morning, I just hope we got a winner. I don't know what the
next Thursday mean Wednesday.
Well, I mean, I'm being nice and said we have one by Thursday. Maybe.
Oh,
I
so
hope we have one.
Unlike every other country in the world where they have results the same, 4 hours after the polls close. Just so you know, there's a decision that came out of the Fifth Circuit. Doesn't bind anybody instantly, but it's a warning. If people are, boy, it's getting no play in the media at all, should get an awful lot, was brought because of some southern states that decided they were going to accept ballots from absentee voting that came in after the close of the polls on Election Day. And they got spanked. And the actual reasoning in the opinion is absolutely ironclad and waterproof. It goes back to original election laws that are as old as the country and to the Constitution itself. There is a very real risk
that, you know, given how politically charged things are these days, that there will be challenges that are filed on and by the way, this is one of the things after 2020, you know, if you remember, Pelosi and her pals pushed through a set of bills that collectively changed how the electoral vote system and such is done within the Congress. Okay, now that's perfectly legal because that's actually not in the Constitution. It's a law. Okay, so, you know, all right, so they changed the law, and Biden signed it, so it stands, and it does a number of things. One of them is that it makes the process essentially ministerial. So what used to be able to happen was you could have a senator and a representative, if one of each chamber filed an objection, then the two chambers had to split, go into their own private sessions and vote on that resolution, either up or down, and then come back and, you know, and continue. Well, that process has been changed. But in addition, what's also been changed is that the Supreme Court has been given plenary authority to hear emergency appeals, and their decisions are binding. Now, prior to that, there was plenty of question over whether or not that was the case, or whether the Congress could say, sorry, the Constitution says we have the plenary authority, and by the way, if we reject a certificate or we accept a certificate, that's our call, nobody else's, end of conversation. And that was because of the way that the electoral count was structured within the existing law. Well, Congress changed that. Okay, fine, except what this means is that if there is a challenge filed at the Supreme Court, they can't duck it. They can't sit on it. They have to either refuse to take it up, or they have to take it up and rule on it expeditiously in enough time for it to have effect. And Congress is required to honor the decision. So if you have a state that takes ballots after the close of the polls, based upon this Fifth Circuit decision, and the other side, and we know who the other side will be because it's the Democrat states that have these extended so-called deadlines, if the GOP comes in there and files an emergency appeal with the Supremes, and the Supremes rule that certificate is invalid, if those ballots are in the ballot stream, Congress cannot override that. There's nothing they can do. They're forced to honor it.
Well, I feel the same way about this early mail voting stuff as I do about how the trading has changed in my industry, Carl. And yeah. So you can say, God, she's really off his rocker this morning. In our industry, when the CBOE was developed, it was developed to take care of a lot of the problems that were seen on both the Board of Trade floor and the New York Stock Exchange. You had competing market makers instead of one person running it. In the New York Stock Exchange, you published the bid and the offer as the quote to the public, as the Board of Trade refuses to do to this day.
Right.
You separated agency from principal. A broker in a pit, if he did an order for another person, he couldn't do an order for his own account in that pit on the same day. You cleaned up a lot of what was basically wrong in the industry, in my opinion. And it allowed people to police their own order. So if you wanted to buy an option in IBM that was 2.25 3/8 and it went to the floor and your 10 lot traded at 2 3/8 because you're buying it, or it's traded at 2.25 because you're selling it, you were able to police your own order, for lack of a better term, and the system was straight. Where the Board of Trade, if you called down there, they'd say it's 1.25 3/8, buy me 10, filled at 1/2, what's the market, 1.25 3/8, you know, that kind of crap. We never got that on the CBOE. Well, now when we went to electronic, because everything has to be faster, quicker, cheaper, all those rules are gone.
Yep.
In principle, you get to show it to people, you get to sell the order flow. The only reason why your company's going to buy it is because they're getting a look before somebody else. So it's inherently crooked. Now, how does this
work? Well, and the other thing is that for people like myself who want to sit at a retail console, there is no way for us to have peer access and be competitive at all anymore.
Because of the speed of the line.
Well, that's right, but it's not just that. It's also that they can get in front of us, and so you get picked off relentlessly, and from my standpoint, essentially made the game it made it unprofitable enough that I stopped doing it.
Well, on the stock side, they can trade within a penny, and you can't. But
right.
On the options, on the option side, like if we put in an order for our people, we do a covered right, we buy the stock and we sell the option at one price.
Right.
So when we learned something by being in the industry 40 years. I mean, and I say it all the time, that's why.
Oh, there's still, Chief, I'm not saying there aren't ways that it still works. There are.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that a lot of the stuff that used to work no longer
right.
does.
Right. Oh, that's why even people say today, what do you need a guy, shameless plug, what do you need a firm like PTI for? When all you do is put the stuff in there, and by the way, it's free most places. Not
obviously. That's yeah, right.
Right. So, but I mean, the fact is, you need us more, because if you have a covered write on and you want to roll to the next month, we don't buy one at the market and sell one at the market. That's suicide. We'll put the order in as a spread with a stock contingency. We move it. We watch it. If the stock moves, we change it. Anyway, but and this, when I had a lady I knew, and I've seen her in years and years, but. She, this is back, it's got to be 10, 15 years ago. When all this kind of started, you know, and she was remember the guy was at Forrest, what the hell was his name, Greg? Forrest, the guy who ran for Cook County Board President, and then he
Claypool,
and then he marched on the county building, and everybody was up in arms about how he's a poor loser and, you know, blah, 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 and he has no business doing that. Well, behind the scenes, it's like the stuff you come up with, Carl, behind the scenes, she was telling me that the way it used to be, because she was election judge for God knows how long, she wasn't a kid. If you were Greg Pappas overseas in the Army and you got an absentee ballot, those ballots had to be into the precinct and before the polls closed. So,
right.
So as an election judge, they'd have 200 people come through the door, and oh, by the way, here's a basket of 10 absentee ballots from your precinct, and you open up the ballot, you look at the person's signature, you got the book right there, one of the books electronic, and you check them off just exactly as if they walked in the door. So the system, I think, was clean. You got the Republican judge, the Democratic judge.
Yeah, well,
but we've gone way beyond that. Now
right.
Both sides, one side's trying to not let people do stuff. I mean, the whole idea that either one, a Republican or a Democrat, stands up and says, I don't care if you vote for me, it's most important that you vote. Yeah, right.
Well, okay, so I mean, like, so one of the things, I mean, you know, this has showed up just in the last couple of days. Michigan, which of course, you know, was one of the states that had all kinds of allegations that cheating went on during the last election, okay? By the way, yes, I know that there were like, you know, 60 cases dismissed. Every single one of them was dismissed on standing. There has never been, from the 2020 election, at no time was there actually a judicial inquiry into the facts that were alleged. Never happened. Okay, so for those people who say that this went through the courts and it was ruled wrong, no, this was dismissed for lack of standing. The facts that were claimed to have been at issue, which is always that's the real situation, right? Did you get, you know, in a trading situation, whatever, did you get robbed or didn't you get robbed, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's supposed to matter is, did you get robbed? Well, it was never adjudicated. No one ever brought the facts up in front of a jury or in front of a judge, and, you know, there's no public record of it because it never got there. But this got a few people in Michigan extremely angry. And in most states, the actual poll books how you voted is private. That you voted is public information. Okay, and I used to be involved in the Libertarian Party. We bought the CDs for canvassing purposes from the Secretary of State's office. And it was small. It's small ball money. Anybody can buy them. And it gives you everybody within the selected area. So, you know, of course, we wanted a congressional district because that's what we were worried about at the time. We were running a congressional candidate.
Sorry to interrupt. How do they get your phone number?
Well, now that is not in those records.
I know.
So
I mean,
that,
so how do I get... I'm getting text messages from everybody.
I know, I'm getting spammed like crazy, and thank God for T-Mobile. They have an automatic spam detector that puts it in a spam folder, and I never see them, because otherwise I would go insane. I probably get 20 of them a day. So what you have, though, is each person has each voter that's registered has a unique identification number. It's not a driver's license, Social Security. It's totally made up. It's used for nothing else. But it is a unique indicator. It's a unique index. And you can go online and look. In most places, you can actually expose that. So you can go on the Secretary of State's website and actually pull that up. But it tells you whether or not you voted. Now, obviously, because of the secrecy of the ballot, it doesn't tell you how you voted. Okay? But it tells you whether or not you did in a given election. And that data is real time. Well, what got caught this time around in Michigan is that there's a guy who got very angry, and so he did the kind of things I do. He started sucking this data down on a daily basis and populating a database with it. And he found one voter ID that had like 29 ballots, not requests, actual accepted ballots.
You sure this wasn't Chicago back in the day?
Well, no, this was yesterday.
Oh.
Okay. Well, needless to say, that got out on social media. The Trump campaign went bananas, as you might expect.
Well, I mean,
right?
Both sides will cheat no matter how they possibly can.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But the thing is this. Apparently, Michigan has interdicted those. They say they're not in the ballot stream. But here's the basis of election integrity, okay? I've got a poll book, and this used to be done on paper, all right? Now it's electronic, but it used to be done on paper. The same principle applies. If I vote early, and I did here in Tennessee, my voter ID has been marked as having been used in this election. I went into the polling place. I showed them my ID. They issued me a ballot. Now, at the point that they issue me a ballot, my voter ID is marked as used for the general election.
I almost wonder if you should want to try it on Tuesday, see if they let you vote again.
They won't. I can guarantee you they will not, because what happens is after early voting closes, which I think it does today in Tennessee, I think today or Friday it closes. Once that happens, the early voting databases, because there's no internet connectivity on these things, these are local computers, that database is then uploaded into the Secretary of State's system, and all those voter IDs that were used in early voting are marked consumed. Okay? And that's it. Now, if I go try to get a ballot on Tuesday, they're going to, you already voted, jackass. And the same thing's true if I ask for an absentee ballot, or in states that allow unrestricted mail voting, in those places, you know, if you asked for a mail ballot. If you asked for a mail-in ballot, your voter ID is marked as used for this election. It's consumed. That's it.
Well, it sounds pretty straight. Does it work that way?
Well, it's supposed to, but how do you get 29 ballots, allegedly in the system under one voter ID? Well, that's intentional fraud, and by the way, it has to have been done within the programming of the management software and at the county level. It is not an accident. It can't be an accident. And if you find something like that, everybody who touched it needs to go to jail, and that particular precinct, county, whatever, must be disqualified.
Last thing I want to do is be a pollster. How bad does Trump have to lose to not say it was rigged?
Well, so I put an article up the other day about this. Legally, if you win a race by one vote in politics, you may as well have won by a million votes. Well, the outcome's exactly the same, right?
Yeah.
But your job as a politician is not to win by one vote. Everybody thinks it is. That's wrong. Your job is to win by enough that the public will not accept a cheat in excess of that amount.
Right. I mean, if you win by 50,000 votes, we know that there's probably five in there that are messed up on both sides, but 50 covers it.
Well, I'm just saying, if I win by a large enough margin that there is no plausible explanation that I actually lost, okay, then I won.
Where do you come down on the the Florida situation, the one with the Bush versus Gore?
Well, the Bush v. Gore thing was an example where the race was closer than the margin of cheating, okay? Because everybody, look, it's politics. People are going to try to cheat. They're going to try to find ways to manufacture a cheat if they, you know, if that's well, what they have
let
to
me,
do.
Let me ask the question more directly. To me, two things happened during that election that were very sort of untoward. One was the famous hanging Chads.
Well, that was 90% of it right there.
Okay, well, there was another one that people forget. I'm surprised you have. The hanging Chads, I think, screwed Gore, okay, to a certain extent. However, the part that people miss, and I try and be fair, I mean, everybody thinks I'm this flaming liberal, but I'm trying to be fair. The news media is not supposed to call a state.
Right, until it closes.
Until it closes.
And they did when the panhandle was still open.
Yeah, the idiots forgot that the panhandle's in Central Time.
Well, here's this goes back to what I said about ballots have to be in by the close of the, you know, of the polls, okay? And this is what that Fifth Circuit ruling was about. If I know what the vote is and the box is still open, I can cheat. If I don't know, if you cannot count any of the ballots until the polls have closed, now I have to guess.
Yeah.
And that is an absolute requirement for an election that the people should accept and will trust the results of. Because otherwise, if I know that one side's ahead by 10,000 votes, and the polls and the poll box is still open, I can still get ballots into the ballot stream, now I know I have to manufacture 10,000 ballots. And that by itself, if that is possible, and I don't care which candidate is ahead at the time, if that's possible, the people should go to the gun cabinet, get them out, and pull Battle of Athens right now. Because
well, I think that
Chief, that's an inherently crooked process,
sure,
and we should not accept it.
Well, what I'm saying is I don't think the people, other than being idiots, I don't think the people at the news media did that on purpose. But my point is, I think Bush got screwed every bit as bad as Gore. Where I'm going with this?
Oh yeah, but yeah. You know, here's the problem I have with this whole thing with the so-called hanging chads. Okay, and I watched.
Well, I'm trying to get to my question in my normal clumsy way.
Well, Chief, you know, Chicago used. I voted that kind of a ballot with the pin poke thing.
So did I for a long time.
Yeah, for over 10 years in Chicago, yeah. For crying out loud.
It was, but the ones here, the pin was pretty specific. I mean, you poked the thing all the way through. There was no hanging
Chief,
shed.
Chief, it's the same thing in Florida.
I never saw a hanging shed in mine. They were all poked through. I mean, maybe I missed.
They were. You know what that was about? That was about trying to figure out people who maybe didn't vote the race at all, and some of them didn't.
Well, that's okay. What I'm saying, Kyle, at some point in this, and boy, Kevin will be all over me how great the Electoral College is, but. At some point, anybody who's had statistics 001, not even 101, in the Florida situation that year, anybody with any kind of common sense had to call that race a dead heat.
Oh yeah,
and
it was stupidly close. Yeah,
I mean, and half of those votes, I don't even know it would have changed the outcome of the election. I don't know if it would or wouldn't. Half of those votes should have gone both ways, and any normal. Anybody around the rest of the world, or if somebody's sitting there on the moon of Alpha Centauri watching our TV, he's got to go, wait a minute, why do all these got to go one way when it's obviously a tie?
Well, but this again goes back to what I said, is that your job as a politician, and this is, and you know, everybody says, well, you know, this guy won't accept it, you know, Harris won't accept it if they lose, Raskin's talking about refusing to certify, which, by the way, he can't do. You know, he's making those kinds of threats, which is crazy. You've got a bunch of people that have taken polls that say, well, you know, half the GOP voters won't accept it if Trump loses. Here's the thing. If we get to election night and it is obvious that one side or the other has blown out the, you know, they've run the table. Right?
Yeah.
It is what it is. All right. But as a politician, that's your job.
Yeah,
And if you can't close the deal at that level, then you know what? You deserve all the controversy that comes.
Well, how is it that all the stuff I get, I don't think they listen to the show, I don't know. Everything I've gotten so far has been from the Democratic side. And yet, I'm going to say that in the last six elections, I think I'm 2-2-2. Two Republican, two Dems, and two Libertarians.
It's amusing because I've got the exact opposite circumstance here in Tennessee. Okay, I don't think I've gotten one Democrat text message or solicitation. All right, not one. All right, I get 20 a day in the text messages, the spams. All right, now here's the thing. Now I'm registered as a Republican because you can't cross party lines during the primaries in Tennessee. Same thing was true in Florida. So if I wanted to vote in the primaries in Florida, I had to pick the one that was going to
Chicago,
make a difference.
If you don't register as a Democrat, there's nobody on the ballot at the primary.
Well, yeah, same thing happens here. If you don't register as a Republican, there's nobody on the ballot, right? You get a blank ballot.
Yeah, so how does that affect anything? I mean.
Well, there's a big argument with open primary versus closed. I used to be involved in that debate a lot within the Libertarian Party because it was obviously a huge deal for third parties, right? Because if you register as a third party and you're in a district that was, you know, had a 20-point swing in the last election for the GOP, for example, all right, then registering as Libertarian means you don't get to vote for whoever is going to actually be on the ballot and going to win in November. The election that matters is not the general because there's a 20-point difference in representation. It is the primary. So the primary is where you choose who your congressperson is. It is not the general election. And screwing yourself out of being able to vote in the primary is... Oh my God. So I mean, the thing is, and when I was a Libertarian Party EC member, I can't register for the GOP when I'm a party official. Okay.
Well, I mean, in Illinois, it's gotten so bizarre that some of the people on one side or the other, and I think it's happened to both Democrats and Republicans, because obviously the northern part here is pretty Democratic and the southern part's not.
Right.
You've had people that are, say, you're running against Attila the Hun and the Republican side, and I'm the Democrat and I don't have anybody there. You've had instances here where I'm giving money to Attila the Hun.
Chief, it's the same sort of situation here in Tennessee, okay? I mean, and same thing you have in Illinois, all right? You're the Illinois that you live in is so blue that whoever's on the GOP side doesn't matter.
I don't know that it's that blue presidentially in the city.
I'm not talking about I'm talking about everything else.
Well, I mean,
okay,
yeah, but you know, thing is, Carl, everybody says that, but we don't. There's not a denominational mayoral elections. There's no Republican Democrat anymore.
But your district's representative. Okay.
Yeah, I get it. I'm saying I'm not. But the point is, everybody keeps saying that Chicago is bleeped up because it's Democrat. It's bleeped up because it's got a falling tax base. It's got all kinds of problems. And, oh, by the way, it's more of an emperorship where some people take all the dough.
And, by the way, your praise of Pritzker and getting the situation under control there, but you do realize that you just had one of your members of your state assembly, guy in a wheelchair. I have to go look his name up again. I saw it yesterday. Gave a nice little speech and said, by the way, we raised taxes on the people of Illinois by $1 billion, and we also increased spending on illegal immigration by $1 million, or a billion, okay? So basically, you as a resident of Illinois are getting screwed out of $1 billion that is going directly to people who have no right to be here.
I got news for you. Nobody spent $1 billion on these people in Chicago. Those people would get that money. Nobody spent that money on them.
Oh, I'm not saying they actually got it all. If you think that 75% of it didn't get grifted off, of course it did.
The people, the group that's by me, okay? And again, I've said this before, and I'm not speaking for everybody, and I'm not speaking for anybody there individually. Half of them are in the Home Depot parking lot. Every Saturday, Sunday morning, I go in there.
Yeah, I know.
Half of them now are walking to the bus every morning. They have some kind of a job. I've never gone by there and smelled marijuana like I smell everywhere else in the damn city. I've never seen anybody drinking outside on the sidewalk because they're outside in the fresh air. I've never seen a fight there. I've never seen anything. Now, what I'm saying is, and I don't see any of those people getting their share of the $1 billion. So there's what's if there's not even 10,000 people. Say there are, what's 10,000 into a $1 billion? That's a lot of money per person. If you just handed it to them, right?
Yeah.
Well, where's it all going?
Well, that's a good question, I guess.
I
think that's kind of a, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing. But I don't know. I just.
But it comes down to misinformation. I mean,
the money's not misinformation. Well, the money's real. The billion dollar tax. Chief, the $1 billion tax increase is real. Who actually gets the $1 billion? That's open to some question.
Without a doubt. And I'm saying.
All right. But the fact that you just got stuck in the keister for $1 billion, that's real.
Well, okay. It's interesting though that our buddy Brendan, who's be on the show, and hopefully we'll be on again one of these days as he gets his health back together, it was real tight. He's involved in the school board money because he's an attorney that specializes in bonds, municipal bonds.
Right.
And he said, Lori Lightfoot, for all her, thin skin kind of bug eyed sort of approach on TV that kind of pissed everybody else off. So she was not a dumb woman. I said the finance department under her was as good as it's ever been. They had really good people there.
No, that's a surprise.
And he said, but now he says they're almost all gone. This guy didn't have anybody. Yeah. This guy didn't have anybody, and there was any good. Well, I mean, he's probably got somebody, but I mean, she had parts of the city that were running. It didn't mean they got any more taxes or people left any different or more industry was here, but. He goes, those people were fine. They were actually very good. Like my stepfather used to say.
That's a pleasant surprise for Chicago.
Yeah, well, my stepfather used to say, he goes, he was a controller. He had his, he wasn't a CPA. He was a accounting degree from DePaul and a GI Bill. And he said, if you ever want to find a really good accounting department, you got to find a firm that's really struggling. He goes, everybody, right. Everybody in there is doing the job right because every penny's worth something. He goes, right. You go to some place where they're all fat, hat, and fabby. He goes, I never hire anybody out of one of those places. I don't do anything.
Yeah, it's it's just I find, it's it all goes back to the same sort of thing though. Is that and this is the left and the social media space is absolutely apocalyptic of the possibility that Trump wins. And he actually puts Musk on a commission to excise the fraud, waste, and abuse in the federal government. Okay.
You know, Musk was allegedly an illegal immigrant.
Well, allegedly he was, yeah. But you know what? He's a citizen now.
I understand. I have my issue. But here's it.
Well, all right. Look, I mean, I know everybody. Look, I bag on the Democrats about this kind of stuff all the time, right? But the fact of the matter is that Ronald Reagan is the one that turned California permanently blue by legalizing 3 million illegal immigrants.
Ronald Reagan did a lot of weird stuff. He also
signed that bill.
We've never had a balanced budget since he was there.
Well, okay, and you know why that happened? Because he made a deal with Tipper Gore, who was the speaker at the time.
Tip O'Neill.
Okay, Tip O'Neill. I'm sorry. On the other side of the on the other side of the game, of course. Right, that he'd get his tax cuts, but in return, O'Neill was going to send him a balanced budget, because of course Congress has to actually pass the budget, right? Because yep. Congress has to appropriate money, and O'Neill, of course, reneged, didn't do it. So Reagan got his tax cuts, and then rather than enforce the agreement, which he could have done, he could have told O'Neill, "Look, I don't care what you send to my desk. Until you give me what you told me you were going to give me in exchange, I'm vetoing everything."
Well, I'm sure there's more to that story,
But O'Neill,
I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet some of those people.
I'm just saying, O'Neill screwed him, okay? And the thing is, he never enforced it. So, and
they ended up having to pass a huge tax increase a year later because they totally misestimated how much money was going to cost them when they
wrecked Treasury when they did that. Yeah,
but I'm saying I fortunately, when I was on the board of the CBO, one of the things I got to do was meet a lot of the politicians, and they would come in, and it was actually people say, well, you know, you're giving these guys all this money. I think the limit in those days, Carl, I'm going to say $500.
Yeah, I think even through the 90s, I think it was because there was, I don't remember what it was. It had no monetary value, but it was something I wanted to gift, and it's like, oh, is it under $500? I'm like, well, yeah, it's worth like $10.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. I mean, it was a memento. It had no monetary value, but yeah, I think it was $500 was the limit.
But what would happen is they'd get somebody'd be in town, you know, some big politician, and there was a person at the CBO whose job it was, among other things, to keep track of these people's schedule and bring them over for a breakfast, and you'd have, you know, your bagels and cream cheese and cookies,
right?
And the guys would sit down, and I was on the board, so I was always invited. And you'd sit down and you'd talk to these guys. You'd tell them about your business. They'd say, you know, what are you finding the problem on the federal side? And, well, God, if this some kind of transfer tax goes through, we're all out of a job. You know, you have a chance, and then you have a chance to ask these people questions. Well, some of the people I ran into, I mean, Tom Foley, who came after Tip O'Neill, I don't think there's anybody now that I can even spot on either party that is in that guy's league. He would sit down there and he would talk to everybody, Democrats, Republicans. He'd answer the question. He wasn't afraid of anybody.
Right.
Dan Rostenkowski was the same way. There was a couple of Republican people there who were the same way. These were real guys.
Oh, no, I know.
And but now everybody is so damn shifty. Nobody wants to sit down with anybody in a room like that and ask normal questions. I mean, one of the guys was Mr. Right-wing dude on the floor. Asked Foley, he goes, you know, look what you guys are doing to education. And Foley goes, okay, what exactly are we doing to education? Okay, you're screwing us up there. He said, you know how many boards of education there are in this country? And the guy goes, well, no, why? And he goes, well, there's like, he had the number right in the top of his head. There's 2014 that independently control education in their system. He goes, you know, in France, everybody in the entire country is on the fifth day of the school year is on the exact same page in the algebra book. He goes, do you want that here? And the guy goes, well, no. He says, well, then what are you talking about? I mean, if you don't want that here, in the federal level here, what we do is we support what we can support. If we find areas that we think people can't afford books, we'll have some kind of a federal book program. He goes, but that's basically not our job, you know, we can put out federal some tests that people can use or free to not use. So he knew way more about this one subject this guy ever dreamed by asking him the question. I mean, these guys were not idiots. Rostenkowski, the same way. I talked to that guy about a tax issue. He couldn't believe that we don't index capital gains. He goes, somebody, they make the money in 1 year and a day. He's, why do they have to pay half taxes? And somebody buys a house 30 years ago, and the house has doubled in 30 years. He goes, that guy's not made any money. Why does he have to pay anything?
Yeah.
He goes, I can't get anybody to agree with me. These people, they were, you know, and I'm saying, we had Phil Graham. Phil Graham, same way. Although I never was a big fan of his wife, because she was what, the Enron girl? Wendy was on the board of Enron. Wasn't she the head of the governance committee for Enron, wasn't she?
Yeah, I think so.
And she was, they were the ones.
You know, fun fact about Enron, guys, I don't know if it's true, but I saw it earlier on the internet, so.
Yeah.
Which company replaced Enron in
the S&P? Well, that's a good question. Boy,
I don't know which one that was. Yeah, that's one of those trivia questions that you get asked at, on Tuesday nights.
But in the saloon, yeah. Who was it?
It's a big one.
Not Microsoft.
It's a big one.
Well, I don't know.
Starts with an N.
NVIDIA?
Yep.
Oh, wow. God.
Oh, God.
Okay.
All right. Oh, it's Halloween. All right. There you go. There's your Halloween conspiracy right there.
Hey, Carl, shift topic for a second. Yesterday, the GDP came out at 2.8.
Yeah, I saw
that. Versus 3.1, so it caused the market to come back a little bit when it came out. I did dig last night.
Well, the ADP report was out yesterday, too, and I think that actually had a bigger impact because it was... It is making very clear, and of course we'll know tomorrow whether or not that's in the BLS data, that Powell's 50 basis point whack was the 1970s mistake.
Could be. I mean, the number was already down there, so you've been the announcement.
Well, okay, but you know what? That curve is IRX TNX is at -174 this morning. That is nearly flat now.
To the extent that I can, because it's a month. How many people do you think? What is a ask question? But I'm going to ask it anyway. How many people do you think today are still getting the weekly money supply numbers, and we're not?
All the people that matter.
Yeah, I think so too. I find that absolutely abhorring. I mean, I just can't even. Anyway, if you look at the last 2 months, we're punting along at a 5 to 6% annual rate increase, which is exactly what Carl was talking about in a different way. That when they pour money in the system, they're lowering the interest, the short-term rates. But what it's doing, finally, because they're not increasing the balance sheet, it's also causing fear in the hearts of long-term bondholders, and that's why your 30-year is up to almost 4.3.
Well, the 10's at 4.288 right now.
Yeah, I'm looking right at it. By the way, if anybody, if you want to know what those are, the 10 is the TNX, and the 30 is the TYX.
Right, and the 13-week bill is the IRX.
Okay, I did not know that. Hey, my question, I got wandered off as usual. The 2.8 increase, yearly increase in GDP, includes a 1.8% deflator. I think everybody who listens to the show should know this by now.
Yeah.
So we're really saying is the total growth yearly on an annual basis now is 2.8 plus 1.8, which is what, 4.6, correct?
Supposedly.
And 1.8 of that is inflation, which leaves real growth at 2.8. If anybody thinks in the last year inflation was 1.8%, have I got a bridge for you?
Well, right. the federal deficit alone is almost 7.
Yeah.
It against the entire economy, not against the size of the federal government, but against the entire economy. It was as of September 30th, okay, when the MTS closed for the year, the fiscal year closed. The federal inflation shove was approximately 7 across the entire economy. So therefore, if you don't have a nominal 7, you're not flat. You're losing ground.
Well, I look at the money supply. You look at that. But even if the money supply is 5 point, we're back inflating.
The problem with the money supply in general is that and. You're right in terms of the economic impact, Chief. Where the problem comes with using that is that that can flip very rapidly because a lot of it is private, right, and not driven by Fed or other public policy.
Well, I've tried to explain that, and with your help, the money supply is the citizens of this country, the way our system is set up, we essentially can impact the money supply, and that's why it's.
Well, if I go to the store and I spend $2,000 on my Discover card, that is on credit, I've put $2,000 into the economy that I didn't first earn.
When
I pay it off, it comes back out.
All right, now use layman's terms here. I'll go to a very simple case, and I'll explain why you are accurate, which you are. If we'll go to Bonanza, if Ben Cartwright walks in and dumps $100,000 worth of gold or silver, whatever they mined in the Ponderosa, into the Virginia City Bank, He just increased the money supply by, because it's dollar deposits in the bank, right, plus cash in circulation, plus safety deposit, or time deposits, right. M2. So he just, the money supply is up by $100,000. And Carl comes in, says, I need to borrow $80,000, assuming we have a 20% reserve requirement. I want to borrow $80,000 because I'm gonna plant whatever the hell you plant in Northern up by Lake Tahoe, and they say, okay, well, Carl's not going to spend it tomorrow. He takes the $80,000 as a loan and now goes into his bank account. So now the amount of money that's in the bank accounts is now $100,000 plus $80,000.
Right.
Now, if somebody comes in for another loan, they can only lend out 80% of Carl's. So now it's 64. So now this all starts to add up. So what the Fed does is moves money back and forth out of the pool of money to maintain a certain growth rate or flat growth rate or whatever they want to do. So that's why. So the Fed has to make sure that it doesn't grow too fast on its own. In times of expansion, the Fed might actually be retarding it. Right. Just to keep it...
Well, they're supposed to.
So now use a credit card. Now, Carl goes in. He essentially has borrowed from his bank, even though he might pay him back. He's borrowed $2,000 from his bank, and it's now going into the checking account of that particular firm.
It goes into Home Depot's checking account.
So now there's $2,000 more in the system. Right, because you borrowed from the bank, but your Carl's account, say it's Chase and not Discover. If it's Chase, Carl could have a checking account at Chase with $100,000, okay, but he didn't touch that. That's still right. There. He essentially took another loan against somebody, maybe even his own bank account, which is even weirder because you're paying interest against yourself, which is what banks do. And now it's in the Home Depot. So $2,000 has gone into the money supply. But to look at it more long-term, money is a good like anything else. Boy, you have that conversation. I tried to say that last night with all these old judges and attorneys. You thought I had four heads. money is a good like anything else. It derives its value from its scarcity.
Right.
If you got 10 bucks in your pocket and everybody else in the country's got 10 bucks in their pocket and some evil weevil sneaks in at night and replaces a 10 with a 20, guess what's going to happen tomorrow? Everything you see. If I owe Carl $20, he's going to say, wait a minute, now you really owe me $40. Because
right.
Because the 20 is worth half, you know, is worth half of what it was yesterday. That's what normal Americans don't think that way. I mean, people think the stock market is up. It's not up at all compared to gold. It's up because of the dollar. Is it up compared to the price of a used car? No, right?
Well, the problem you have with this is that any time, you know, when I go and I pull out that Discover card and I do that at Lowe's or Home Depot, what I've done is I've added systemic leverage to the system.
Correct.
And when I pay it off, I've taken out systemic leverage from the system. And people think that the Fed is the only one who does this, and that's just a complete load of crap.
No, we do it, and the Fed is the referee.
Right. Every single person does it every day.
Yes.
And so we all, as participants in the economy, we're the ones who drive this to a large degree. And this is that was the reason that earlier this week you saw this huge spike in the market when the consumer confidence number came out, because essentially, what the consumer confidence number is a barometer on people's willingness to expand leverage in the system.
Right. Somebody's willing to take on the second mortgage for the $50,000 new bathtub because they think the future's bright and they can pay it off.
Right. And that's and so, you know, there is supposed the Fed is, and to a significant extent Treasury are supposed to be regulators on this. Of course, yeah. Good luck with that, right? In today's world,
well, and we look at like the stock markets,
but they all want it to go one direction.
Sure, but I mean, there's no way they're going to either side, because the one guy when he was in office, all he did was say that when the market went up is because of him. There's no way he's going to come in, or the Democrats want the market, you know, correcting 30%, because you all of a sudden, everybody at the table I was with last night, everybody's, you know, these older retired judges and attorneys.
Yeah, they all see their account balance
all
go
of a sudden,
down.
It was like you stuck them where the sun don't shine. I mean, like, what do you mean? I deserve this. Well, okay, I love it. I think my clients do too, but I also know that we can go. This is a wealth thing. It's not an. When people stock goes up and you borrow against your account, and you buy more stock, then that goes up and your margin keeps going. That's why usually market tops also are a top in margin interest, correct?
Yeah, and that's, well, yeah, because it's, you know, it's like everything else. It's everyone, despair is always oversold and greed is always overbought, right? I mean, that's just the way, that's human nature.
Yep.
All right, and it's a lot like the political situation in that you have both sides of the aisle telling us that it's a catastrophe if the other side wins, and I'll just take one specific little area.
Well, it's a catastrophe if you're on the dole on one side or the other.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, for example, we have this catastrophizing that's going on by the people on the left. That the environment will be destroyed with carbon dioxide emissions if Trump wins, and it will be made much better if the so-called Reduction Act is continued, which, by the way, Biden has admitted was actually really the Green New Deal, okay, in that it was designed to drive, allegedly, a reduction of carbon emissions. Okay, so maybe that's important, maybe it's not. But if you look at the carbon dioxide levels and you chart them over the last 30 years, right? So, you know, we've had Democrat governor, we have Republican government, right? You'll see that it is a monotonic line from the lower left to the upper right with the seasonal variation up and down that always happens because, you know, we burn more fuels in the wintertime to heat things. And it makes absolute, there's no change in the slope based on whether there's a Republican or a Democrat in the offices. And that's in Congress and at the presidency. Zero change. Zero in the slope.
But that's the beauty of the big lie.
Well, I'm just saying, the whole thing is BS.
Okay? I've had.
But what's not BS is the inflationary impact and the cost impact that these policies press on people.
Without a doubt. But there's people that are getting this dough.
Oh, I understand. And this is not just... Look, this isn't being done, and this is what I've tried to explain to people, and they look at me like I have six heads. This isn't being done because people within the government are truly concerned about, you know, so-called climate change and the impact on the environment. We live in a world today, and you're old enough to know this, but anybody younger than 40 is not. We live in a world today that is ridiculously cleaner in the United States than it was 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
All right? And I mean, it's not, we're not talking small improvements.
No,
here.
No, we're not even close.
I mean, that I don't have two extra eyes in the back of my head as a result of all the pollution I inhaled
and
ingested.
Sure as hell don't want to go into it on the air, but I can give you... people in my family, I mean my extended family, and I'll bet anybody can do this. You trace the people that worked in a lot of these factories and stuff after World War II.
Oh, yeah.
And what they looked like and how early they died and what they
and what
died
happened
from.
To them, yeah.
I mean, I'm convinced my grandfather died from, he was a boilermaker, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't, when he died of this nasty lung cancer, I'm going to say, I don't know if you can tell after you embalm somebody, but it had to be mesothelioma, didn't it?
Well, quite possibly. I mean, you
know,
how much
asbestos was in those things?
Well, I was going to say, what do you think they used for the insulation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, but this is, that's the thing is that, you know, I mean, how much lead did I end up eating as a kid from the paint, right? So, I mean, it's just, there's all this stuff, but so much of it is, in fact, competence, all right? You take a look at what happened in Flint with the water lines.
Hey, I just pulled this up, by the by, because we were talking about it. As of September... it looks to me like we have a record margin loans of $813 billion.
Right? Yeah, it's at stupid high levels right now, which is really bad.
All right, go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
All right, so Flint, you know, a bunch of kids got poisoned by the water lines, okay? And the current Democrat administration has made a big deal out of this.
But, well, listen, poisoning kids is a big deal no matter who's in power, right? But, Chief, those lines have been in the ground since the 1920s and 1930s, feeding those houses, which were there during the industrialization and, you know, from the Henry Ford times going forward, right, when all the car plants were in Flint. They didn't poison anybody. Why didn't they poison anybody? Because we had competent people running the water plant that understood that the chemical balance of the water had to be maintained or the lead would leach out of the pipe and end up in people's cups. And they ran that plant correctly, and as a result, nobody got poisoned.
Well, was it?
Now they switched. Now here's the thing: they switched the water supply.
That's what I'm saying.
Right, but by the time they had done, when they did that, when they made that decision to do that at the city, they didn't have the people running the water plant who understood the chemistry requirements to keep those pipes safe. They were gone. And as a result, you poisoned a bunch of black kids.
All right, we got to give someone this whole story, and maybe you know more about it than me. As I recall, there was a water supply coming from someplace through a plant, and it became too expensive or something. So
it was coming from Detroit.
Okay, and then they
and so Detroit and the prices were going up, and so they switched the supply
to where their supply was before, which just comes out of one of the rivers.
Out of the St. Clair River or something like that. Yeah, but they changed the intake from where it was coming from to a new source.
But they ended up using a plant that they hadn't used in a while or something, right? Or something like that?
Well, essentially what it came down to is it shifted the pH of the water.
Right.
Okay. And lead pipes self-protect like aluminum does.
All right, the question I'm on the tip of my tongue here is, did the water they get from Detroit, was it already potable, meaning drinkable, or were they getting it straight from wherever Detroit got it and had to use their own filtration plant?
Well, they still had to treat it because...
Okay, so they still had to treat it, right? So it's not like everyone parked buying water from Chicago where it's already treated.
It still has to be balanced because in the transit, the chlorination level will go down and you could get contamination and things like that. So you still have to test and treat at the water plant, okay, but they did not have the chops remaining within their administrative structure and their operational structure at Flint to understand what was going to happen. And if they had, and if they had maintained the balance, which is part of the job of running a water plant, is maintaining that chemical balance and the mineral levels and the pH.
But the problem is, how do you keep your people?
Well, Chief, this is what happens when competence doesn't matter anymore. Okay, it's why we can't go to the moon today.
Well, did you, I'm going to have him back on. You know, I'd love to have him back on with you. My buddy Bill Moriarty, the civil engineer, was on talking about the hurricane stuff.
Yeah.
And he was saying that unbeknownst to most, sometimes I think I keep thinking of the Bourne Identity when the guy gave the sermon for the... Read over him, as they say in the John Wayne movies. The guy that got killed, what's his name? David, the good guy who got killed, where the guy from France was saying he did public service when public service was still something you could do for a life and be good. You get paid for it. You did a good job for people. Well, Bill was saying that the civil engineering, like the Illinois Highway Authority and Florida Highway Authority, he goes, just about across the board, and the guy's worked with many different states, these guys are really good at what they do. They're amazingly imaginative. They work real well with the engineering firms. The engineering firms have guys there that are so clever when they do this stuff. It's amazing, the imagination and how good they are.
Yeah, but it's going away.
But now civil engineering is not something people strive to be in at Purdue or Michigan or someplace.
It's going away. And look, you have an example of it right now in Asheville. All right, the linemen all showed up there to go put the lines back together, right? Because, you know, of course, the storm trashed it. Okay.
Talking electrical lines or the other stuff?
Electric lines.
Okay.
All right, no power. You got no water plant because guess what? The water plant needs electricity, right?
Yep.
All right, so they're out there. They've been working now for 4 weeks, and the city and county haven't paid them. They went on strike yesterday. because they haven't been paid. You know, when I lived in Florida for 20 years and went through a bunch of storms, and I have a bunch of friends of mine who live in other parts of Florida that, of course, have gone through even more because, you know, Florida's basically a storm magnet, gets hit all the time. I have never seen anything like that. Those guys, I mean, okay, yeah, it's expensive. They're getting paid double overtime. You have to get out there and get the lines back up. They make a lot of money doing it. And you know what? But it is a nasty job getting up there on, you know, on a pole.
Tomorrow,
these guys are getting Chief. These guys are getting deliberately screwed, and this is and they're saying, you know what? We're in this to help you, but we're also expecting to get paid, and we're not even getting the per diem to pay for our hotel rooms.
One of my buddies from the Tripoli. One of the lady bartenders whose dad actually graduated with me. How scary is that when you're old? He was on the national championship team in 1973. Anyway, her husband, boyfriend/husband, now husband, is one of these high wire guys. I mean, and he's one of the nicest guys you ever want to meet. Whenever I see him, I can't wait to talk to him for a half hour about what's going on in the industry. One of these hurricanes, not this one, but way before COVID, they were asked to go down to somewhere to get all in the trucks, and they're heading down to someplace, Carolina or someplace, where the guy calls him and says, you know, by the way, we're not paying you guys union wage. He goes, what do you mean? they turn the trucks around. Said, screw you guys.
Well, these guys that are down there in Asheville, they're getting screwed.
Yeah.
Okay? And I mean, and the thing is, that all the time I lived in Florida, that kind of crap just never happened.
No.
And if you think there's not a difference in administrations, I got news for you. The governor's office and the county offices in Florida, they made sure those people were taken care of because they were the ones that were getting the lights back on.
Yeah.
And yet, here we are in North Carolina. It's got a Democrat governor. Becumbee County is full of Democrats. It's 100%. You've got the Asheville City Council is 100% Democrats and all women.
I don't think the competency or lack thereof that you're seeing in society is one party versus another.
No, I don't. But I tell you what, the degradation and that it's allowed to go on.
Well, it is allowed to go on.
It's the political process in this country.
They think you could put people in these jobs that aren't take our mayor, for instance, that have no idea what they're doing, and it'll turn out all right. No, it won't. It will, unless there's some sort of a. We got a dash, but
Chief, I'll give you the best example. Homer Simpson. We're going to end up with Homer Simpson in the nuclear plant.
I got a schedule. Carl was on today. He covered for Dan. Dan's going to be on tomorrow, but Carl's still going to come on at 7:30 and do the labor report with Dan. So we won't be. But I got one for you that'll never happen again. This guy Bob, he runs a Sunday morning softball, and yeah. Bob was a real good softball player. But he's getting up there. He drafts the team. He puts himself at shortstop, and I'm going, that's interesting. he might have been marginally better there than me. These guys, they love softball. We don't even play just seven innings. We play nine, even if it's 100 degrees, right?
Oh, wow.
Guess what? He never got a ball. Nine innings. It was fine. So if you become a lineman for the county and it never rains,
It never rains, you don't got a problem.
I guess you're okay. SP Futures down 37. SP Futures down 144 again. Meta's down 720. It's coming back some. Microsoft is not. It's still down 16. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.